I'm Arun Van Gopal, in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump announced his long-awaited plan for the Middle East, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stood next to him.
This is an unprecedented and highly significant development. Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for having the courage to take this bold step forward.
The plan, which Trump is calling Peace to Prosperity, lays the groundwork for what Trump and Netanyahu say is a two-state solution, but would in fact only give a Palestinian state limited sovereignty. It also gives Israel the green light to maintain control over its settlements in the long-contested West Bank region, and addresses another contested place in all this, Jerusalem.
Under this vision, Jerusalem will remain Israel's undivided, very important, undivided capital.
Trump said the proposed plan is a win-win for both Israel and Palestine, but the actual details strongly favor Israel. Most significantly, Palestinians were not involved in the negotiation of this plan and rejected the proposal before it was even released. The so-called peace plan's unveiling comes at a time when both Trump and Netanyahu are wrapped up in political controversies. Here in the U.S., the impeachment trial is still underway in the Senate, and in Israel, Netanyahu is facing corruption charges while also preparing for yet another election in March. We're joined now by Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, focusing on U.S. foreign policy. He's also a former State Department Middle East negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations. Aaron, great to have you back on the show.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Shibli Talhami, a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Shibli, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Tell us, Aaron, what are the major points that the president outlined in his plan yesterday?
I mean, it's clear that what the administration has done in announcing a long-awaited and I would argue ill-named peace plan has all kinds of objectives, but negotiating Israeli-Palestinian peace is not one of them. On the three core issues that are germane and with which American negotiators, Israelis, Palestinians have struggled for decades, what to do about the territorial component of a two-state solution, how to handle the very volatile and emotional, religiously driven issue of Jerusalem, and the matter of Palestinian refugees. On each of these points, the administration has come down solidly, in my judgment, on the side of Israeli needs and requirements, trivializing and ignoring Palestinian ones. Bottom line here, to me, is that, yes, this is about politics. It's about Netanyahu's domestic situation, Trump's desire to help him, about Trump's own reelection, need to secure evangelical support, conservative Republicans and the like. But above all, what's driving this plan and why it's going to fail is it purports to revise decades of American policy, failed though it may have been, on how to create, in my judgment, the least bad solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is a two-state solution.
Shibli, it is striking, even Orwellian, for the administration to call this a peace plan when one side was entirely absent. And even more striking, I think, is that this term, peace plan, has been adopted by much of the U.S. media, including the New York Times, the AP, MSNBC. What, if anything, does this tell us?
Well, this is really unfortunate. It does tell you that the Trump administration has succeeded in some ways in framing the issue over the many months that it's been talking about it as a peace deal or deal of the century, when in fact it has very little to do with peace. And certainly it's not even a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. What it is a plan, an annexation plan. It's really a plan to help the Israeli right implement what it has always wanted, which is legitimize Israeli settlements, annex Jerusalem, annex other parts of the West Bank, and give the Palestinians minimal control in the territories where they live.
Now, according to the plan, Palestinians would be given a path to statehood if they meet a set of tests. What are those tests?
Well, first of all, let's think about what, even if they meet those tests, what we're talking about here. Israel would control the waters. Israel would control the air. Israel would control the borders. Israel would control the security. Even the path of security path or the security for the path linking Palestinian enclaves in Israeli territory and the path linking Jewish enclaves in Palestinian territory. So what we're talking about here is non-contiguous territories. We're talking about very limited control that would sovereign meaning in the way we understand sovereignty. So it's more like autonomy than a state. It's just a name, a label given to it called a state.
The administration has repeatedly singled out Palestinian leadership. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was the driving force behind this peace plan, and he spoke about the leadership in very unflattering terms yesterday on CNN with Christiane Amanpour.
You have 5 million Palestinians who are really trapped because of bad leadership. So what we've done is we've created an opportunity for their leadership to either seize or not. If they screw up this opportunity, which again, they have a perfect track record of missing opportunities. If they screw this up, I think that they will have a very hard time looking the international community in the face, saying they're victims, saying they have rights. This is a great deal for them. If they come to the table and negotiate, I think they can get something excellent.
Aaron, given Kushner's hostile tone, what does that say about how the Trump administration is viewing the leadership in all of this?
Well, from the beginning, I've had half a dozen meetings with Mr. Kushner, and I have to say, that during my first meeting with him, I said to him half jokingly, I wish my father-in-law had as much confidence in me as his father-in-law had in him, because he's given him Mission Impossible. And I made it unmistakably clear to him he couldn't fix this problem. It's up to the Israelis and Palestinians with fair and judicious American mediation to take the kinds of decisions that are required. But from the beginning, he clearly identified for me what he considered to be the major problem. And that was a Palestinian leadership that was dysfunctional. It had failed. Right now, the Palestinian national movement looks like Noah's Ark. There's two of everything. Two statelets, one in Gaza, one in the West Bank, two sets of security services, two separate constitutions, two visions of where Palestine should be and what it should be. So this notion that the Palestinians were the root cause of the problem has informed the Trump administration's approach to this issue from the get-go. And it's reflected. And I have to say, I worked for Republicans and Democrats and voted for them, too. I've never seen an administration in the 25 years I worked on this problem more preternaturally supportive of Israel, applying ample amounts of honey at every opportunity, and literally at political and economic war and confrontation with the Palestinians, applying only vinegar. This has been a central tenet, I think, of the Kushner-Trump-Friedman plan from the beginning. You make the Palestinians dependent on the Arab states, and you make it unmistakably clear to them that they've lost. And Shibley rightly brings up David Friedman as a bankruptcy attorney. The logic for the Trump administration is the following. It's Friday, you get 50 cents on the dollar. If you don't agree by Sunday, it's 25 cents on the dollar. And if you're still not convinced by Monday or the following week, we'll give you a dime on the dollar. And that's the logic here. And frankly, I don't care where you stand or sit on this conflict. Unless you really try to meet the core needs of both parties and strive for a balance of interests, not much difference than a good marriage, a good business proposition, a good friendship. Each side needs to have their needs and core requirements met with the understanding that they also need a compromise in an effort to reach a workable and equitable solution. That's not the Trump administration's approach.
Shibley, we've been talking about the Palestinian leadership, but how are the Palestinian people responding to this?
Of course, they read it as a cruel joke. I mean, to think the Palestinian people think that Jared Kushner has their interests in mind is a joke of the century. This is the administration that not only, quote, took Jerusalem off the table, a very central issue to every Palestinian, but also cut off humanitarian aid to the Palestinians and to the refugee agencies, particularly UNRWA. In a way that has hurt the Palestinians in a real way at a very deep level. So obviously that's a joke. And in fact, when you read the documents say, oh, the Palestinians deserve this and the Palestinians have suffered, I think it does sound to them like a cruel joke. But with regard to the leadership, you know, undoubtedly you could make criticism of the leadership, and I think it's warranted, and Palestinians themselves make criticism of the leadership. But let me say this, there's no Palestinian leader, right or left, moderate or hardliner, religious or non-religious, who in any shape or form could possibly accept any version of this plan. So this is a joke also to say, to blame it on Palestinian leadership.
Aaron, while Netanyahu was in Washington this week, Israel's attorney general formally indicted him on corruption charges. How does that factor into this rollout?
It's really interesting, and we're really in terra incognita here, because there's never been an indictment of a sitting Israeli prime minister charged with bribery, breach of trust, and fraud. He applied for immunity by a date certain, but then he, yesterday, day before, withdrew immunity. So technically, well, he's now formally been indicted by the attorney general as a consequence of withdrawing his request for immunity. And now the issue is when to schedule a trial. And the Supreme Court may actually have to rule on whether or not it is legal, lawful, assuming Mr. Netanyahu fares well enough in the next election to put together a government, whether it is lawful for a indicted prime minister to actually put together a government. I suspect they'll rule in his favor. But just one additional point on this. You know, Ehud Olmert, former prime minister, was indicted, although he had resigned, and formally charged, I believe, in 2009. The indictment was not upheld till 2016, 7 years later, and then he served 8 months in jail. This is not going to end quickly.
What has Netanyahu's political opponent, Benny Gantz, said about this plan?
Gantz is trapped, and I think we have to get over the notion that the fundamental divide in Israeli politics today is between left and right. It's not. The left has been completely decimated. The Labor Party that helped create the state and led it up until 1977 as a dominant party is a shadow of its former self. The debate in Israel is between the right wing, the Netanyahu bloc, including the religious parties and the Zionist nationalists, and the center right, headed by Mr. Gantz, who frankly is a representative of the old right, of the old Likud. Gantz is going to have a very hard time challenging Netanyahu on this position because there's great consensus on the Jordan Valley. There may well be a fair amount of consensus on applying Israeli law to the settlement blocks and the settlements. Gantz would probably take a more pragmatic approach if he were running the railroad, but he's not. So here he's going to have to play a kind of second fiddle again until the elections. Should he do well? I think Shipley made the point earlier that he'd be less inclined, you know, to formally annex and or provoke.
Shibley Tilhami, professor of government politics at the University of Maryland. Aaron David Miller, former State Department Middle East negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. Thank you both.
Arun, thank you.
Good to be with you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.